This is radio station WTWW, Lebanon, Tennessee, broadcasting at 9480 kilohertz. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is the QSO radio show. It's all about ham radio. And today, it's the rebroadcast of Friday's broadcast at the Dayton Hamvention 2012. Brought to you by Transworld Antennas and Ham Test Online.
Very sophisticated, knowledgeable people.
Correct.
But why? Because it hasn't been made by NASA, which is a government-controlled organization. The amateur satellites are probably better built. Okay.
Well, I won't say that. I will say that a lot of the people...
I would say I suspect that. Okay.
We don't want to say that because we still have lots of friends in NASA. In fact, a lot of our people are NASA people.
But as I'm holding this little board in my hand, I'm thinking... This works in a near vacuum. This works at minus 250 degrees Celsius, works at plus 250 degrees Celsius. And on the surface, it looks like something you'd see in your TV set or in your cell phone or something or other. Yet, and you can actually see it looks like it was put together by hand.
Yes.
Not some kind of fancy machine to it.
No.
And doggone, this thing works. And it's going to work for a dozen years.
That's the plan.
Keith, that is fascinating.
That's the plan.
So fascinating.
I know you've been wanting to get away from here. And I kept you here longer.
They put those boards and the electronics through a lot of testing before they even launch it.
We call it shake and bake. What we do is we vibrate it because we simulate the launch. And then we also put it through the thermal test. We take it up to real high temperature and take it down, and we also put it in a vacuum when we're doing that. It's called thermal vac, and it's just the same thing that happens with commercial satellites. We do this. We have to see, that's the other thing, is that all of our satellites have to meet the same standards that a commercial satellite would, because if ours doesn't work right or creates a problem with the launch, we could mess up a multi-million dollar satellite, somebody else's.
So I'm wondering if somebody wants to launch this huge satellite and this little CubeSat comes out and it bumps into it or something.
Well, that's the problem. Yeah. That's the issue.
Exactly.
So, but now that would, I imagine, would be the area of concern for the mechanics who figure out how these things are going to separate.
Yeah. For example, we're not allowed to turn this on until it's been in orbit for 45 minutes after deployment. So that's one of the stipulations that we have.
A lot that goes into it.
Absolutely.
That's fascinating, Keith. That's terrific.
Well,
I love it.
It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun because we're doing some things that not everybody else is doing, which is really interesting.
Well, I want to thank you for coming by here. You've answered a lot of questions, and I think there's a lot of folks that... What I like about this is the fact that you can actually talk to us and tell us things in terms of this is not... way out beyond the grasp.
Absolutely
of
not.
Average ham.
If anything, it's the other way, Ted. It's a part of our hobby. It's a part of our service. And we are a separate service, by the way. We're the amateur satellite service. It's the amateur radio service and the amateur satellite service. So there's two different services here that we're talking about. The amateur satellite service is separate and apart from the amateurs. But we're hams. I mean, we're all licensed operators, and we use amateur radio frequencies, so it's the same thing. But anyway, Ted, appreciate the chance to stop by.
I appreciate you coming by.
Appreciate what you do, and this is just fantastic.
I didn't want to wear you out, but I did want to ask that question. So. We got a gentleman over here that's wanting to sit down, and we're trying to, I guess I want to say, make sense out of our broadcast here right now, which it gets pretty hectic here at Dayton because we got so many different people coming and going and whatnot. So I want to find out who this gentleman is, and I want to find out what it is that, as soon as he negotiates the headphones there. Why don't you introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about who you are, what brings you to Dayton.
Oh, my name is H.J. Hohensee. I work for Radio Waves. We make wire antennas or whatever you want. We make them all. So anything from just your standard dipole to a G5 or anything, we make it.
So you make antennas?
Absolutely.
Okay, now these are wire antennas?
Yes, sir.
Do you make any other antennas other than wire antennas?
Well, we can, like I said, we can make anything. Right now we're working on a NVIS antenna for the military. They're already being used in the field, but we're just trying to make them a little bit stronger.
All right. For those that don't understand it, what does NVIS mean?
Near vertical incident systems, and what those particular ones do, and I'm a traffic handler on 75 meters, and an NVIS antenna would allow me to have better contacts within the state of Ohio.
Too,
okay,
right.
So it's not something that's going to be a full skywave thing. It's trying to do this at a very high angle and bounce down within the normal skip zone.
Mm-hmm. So it sends your signal not quite straight up, so that it, instead of trying to skip it out 5,000 miles,
we only want a couple of hundred miles at most.
Well, NVIS antennas have also been referred to as cloud burners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. That's why the main reason we were really building them is for the mountains in Afghanistan. And the front-to-back ratio and everything. We have right now. We are the antenna is about 30 dB gain higher than the average. You know,
30. You said
30 dB gain.
Wow.
Yeah. Than the than
That's
the actual
a thousand
flip-up.
Times power. Like
well, well, basically
30 dB.
Well, I mean, we worked really hard on it. Two of my best friends are in the service. Both of them went to Iraq. I had a really close connection to what was going on over there, and. It was, we were approached by my friend who's a commo, Dan Fagan. He's actually out of the service now, but he kept having the issues with the blade antenna. It wasn't doing anything it was supposed to do. So we made a better mousetrap.
So what goes into the design of an NVIS antenna that seems to have 30 more dB gain than something we were using before?
Well, it really comes down to placement. When it comes to wire antennas, where you put... choke points, for insulation and everything, that's where, it gets the front-to-back ratio and the better, instead of, like, having a flip-up, which is, your body blocking happens a lot, so it would be an issue.
How large are these antennas, and for what frequencies?
About 30 feet, or 3 feet, excuse me. Sorry, I'm a little tired. They're about 3 feet long, and we can really cut them for anything that you want to cut for.
All right, so somebody would say wanting to look for working some close-in stations, 75-meter mm-hmm. phone, 3.8 megahertz. 3 feet of antenna can be made to radiate efficiently?
Yes, sir.
Wow.
It uses the human body as an antenna.
Oh, so this is an antenna you actually are wearing.
Yeah, it actually goes into your gear and actually gets threaded through and over your gear. And you are the antenna.
That is fascinating mm-hmm. because you would think that something like that would work on a mobile installation, somebody trying to get a better signal that
it,
way.
It does mm-hmm. make sense for the military because they're out in the middle of nowhere actually,
yes.
And they don't really have the facilities to plug into 110 volt AC. All they have is battery power, so they have to have a very efficient antenna system with very low power.
How does it work into all this? I mean, on the new licensing, mm-hmm. All these. Questions on RF exposure, okay? Now, I've worked in commercial broadcast radio all my life. I mean, I have been exposed to so much RF that if RF could do damage, I ought to be, locked up in a room somewhere drooling on myself, okay? Which is probably not too far from to be. But, I mean, okay, but now you're transmitting using your body as an antenna.
Mm-hmm.
How much RF can you put through your body without,
I'm not dead.
Again,
so.
the FCC set physical limits on that. But even at that, you would have to be exposed to those levels for a very, 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 very long time.
Mm-hmm. But you're not radiating that from your body. You're using your body as a counterpoise. Then is that
that's
what
correct.
It is?
That's correct.
You're actually using the wires mm-hmm. that are near you as a counterpoise, and that's coupling into your body. Is that how that works?
That's pretty much it. Yeah.
Wow.
You're letting all my secrets out.
And but you guys made it work. How much power do these backpacks have for our military guys?
Actually, I do not know the answer to that. I have not had any real hands-on experience with what they use. I know that they use...
No pun intended, no hands-on experience.
Yeah, exactly.
I would imagine it's not going to be much more than 20 or 30 watts. They really don't have a whole lot of power to work with. I mean, as far as battery power. Yeah.
I know that they have some handheld radios that they use, and then after that they will have the unit will have a big radio, and they can use the antenna for that.
In the real world, some of our soldiers out there, when they're carrying these around in the real world testing, how has that helped affect the outcome of the stuff they do?
Well, actually, my best friend was telling me about a story about his friend when they were over there. He ended up, his friend, they were on a building, and they were getting sniper fire. And it was, he actually got shot, and the bullet went up and around the helmet, like around over the top, and cut everything open, and he was knocked out, just gone. And then he didn't die, but they had to go into the building to get away from the sniper fire. They pulled him in, and the antenna that they used, which was a good, I think it was, he said it was like 20 miles away, in a building, was able to get medevac and get him to the med tent, and he's alive now. So,
are these antennas available to everybody?
You can buy them. We do make a civilian version for police officers and search and rescue people. We're trying to, a lot of people use them for that, and they work really, really well. It's altered, semi-altered for civilian, but honestly, it's pretty much the same antenna.
It's radio waves.
Radio waves, you can.
What's your website?
Radiowaves.com, www.radiowavz.com.
What are some of the other things that you're developing as far as wire antennas? Because sometimes when you first start in a ham radio, you don't have that much of a budget, or you just don't want to maybe put so much into it. And a lot of people have tried to put a piece of wire up, and it just doesn't work really well. How do you guys help us out?
Well, we have plenty of options. Radio waves, we make really good antennas for a really good price. We understand the market today. We understand that really nobody has any money, and that really stinks. So what we try to do is have an array of antennas, some of our lower-end stuff and our higher-end, but all the same quality. Everything we have is made with, you know, high-impact plastic. All of our wire is UV-protected. And so any radio waves antenna you buy is going to have quality and will work really well. The G5RV is kind of a standby for new hams. You know, they can get a junior, which works 10 through 40, or a G5RV, you know, the big one, which works. It's 102 feet, and it works all the way up to 80 meters. So, I mean, there's plenty of things that we have that would definitely fit anybody's budget. Now, we can go all the way up to $350 antennas, but... You know, for the serious DXer, but there's expensive ones. But honestly, where we have been really focusing our time is trying to figure out just reliability. I mean, just really make our antennas reliable.
That's certainly though an interesting concept. You know, the utilizing the body. I mean, because I was younger, I remember tuning up trees. You know, getting an antenna tuning unit, tuning trees up, and that sort of thing. So it's just that is a really cool thing, especially if you're thinking about using the body as a counterpoise.
Absolutely.
Well, I remember when you would hold like a VHF or a UHF handheld radio, some of you would be a counterpoise there. When I say you are talking about your body, the cases of some of the old handheld radios were like literally a half wavelength at 450.
And I always thought that, you know, that we wanted to protect the body from RF radiation. Here I am. I took the time and patience to put a tower on top of this hat for
great.
A counterpoise, and one that could have used my body.
Yeah, and you can stop by our booth, and we can give you a little bit more information on it. Emmett's actually going to be here Saturday. And I just want to shout out real quick to everybody listening. If you have a radio waves product and you have an issue with it, we are always going to answer our phone. We're always going to take the time to figure out what the problem is, and we stand by our product. So,
I'm not going to get a computer when I call them up.
No, you know,
no. Oh, that's great.
Basically, bottom line is we care about our customers. We care about the ham. And we know that, especially in this industry, it's really hard to get companies to really give a crap, really. And it stinks because, you know, we're all people. We definitely stand by our product.
Well, we appreciate you coming by here and talking to us. And we'll have to have you back again sometime as a guest on the show to talk about some of these unusual antennas. We got a fellow waiting.
WGWW use one of those antennas, maybe?
it's possible. We have a gentleman here that is wanting to talk to us, and he is with, I believe, is it 1010? Is that it? I want to make sure I got this right. And his name is Mel. So say hello, Mel. Get up on that mic and...
Okay, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to the multitudes.
Get up a little bit closer.
Oh, okay.
There we go.
Yeah, I'm with 1010 International. We were organized 50 years ago During that period of time, the RF cycle of the sun cycle was at a low period, and propagation was not very good in the HF bands around 28 megahertz. During that same period of time, the amateur radio service lost a portion of the what we call the DX band at that time, which was the 27 megahertz band, and it was given to the Citizens Radio Service because they needed to expand and they were operating in the 450 megahertz area. When the FCC was questioned about this, they were told that the reason it happened is because the band wouldn't be in used. Well, is that low at part the of the...
At the time it wasn't, but as they found out a few years later when the sunspot cycle hit a very high maximum, just a few years later, 27 and 28 megahertz became very much alive worldwide.
Right, and as a result, several amateurs were quite upset, and they decided we need to organize together and have activity on 10 meters. For the last 50 years, 6 days a week, at 1800 UTC, or at 10 a.m. West Coast time, on 28 megahertz, they hold a net. In the recent years, since the novice enhancement, we've held a net on 28.8 at 1800 UTC and 28.380.
Now, just for the purpose of explaining to listeners who are not ham radio operators, you say net, and we need to explain exactly what a net is. I mean, I know it's a network, but kind of explain exactly what that net really is.
Okay, well, what we consider a net in amateur radio is you have a control operator who asks for stations to check in and give their information and log these stations in as participating members. And this is basically what a net is in amateur radio. We have different types of net. There is emergency nets held on the bands during emergency situations. There's traffic nets set up to handle health and welfare. And then there's what we call social nets.
So the control operator controls all the traffic or all the information that's flowing through the net through his station so that it can go efficiently from point A to point B.
Right. Well, if you don't...
As efficiently as possible.
Yeah, if you don't have a controlled operator, well, then you have confusion.
Well, it sounds like what you would have is a series of stations with a leader out there that says, you talk now, you talk next, etc.
That's basically, you give your call sign, the net control operator, well, basically I'll give you the exact procedures we do. When you check into one of our operators' nets, you're issued a number, which is your check-in number. And if time goes on, if you want to make a contact with someone else that is on the net control operator will say, is there any contacts that are to be made? And you will give him, well, I'm number 25. I'd like to make a contact. He'll come back to you and let you contact another member who has checked into the net. Of course, now, with 1010, to promote this activity, we issue a 1010 number. That's a membership number. That membership number is yours for life, whether you are a current or non-current member. Whether you pay your dues or do not pay your dues, this number is yours as long as you live. And even after you pass away, it remains on the database and never will be reissued. So this is kind of unique.
Now, this is, you said 1010, strictly 10-meter activity.
It's nothing. We're promoting the use of the 10-meter band.
I remember the first time when I got bit the hardest by the ham radio bug was in 1959. We were just coming off that huge cycle. And the club station that I was going to be at, I wasn't even in high school yet. They were talking to a station, Great Britain. He was like 30 over 9. It was like, you know, a perfect. And I said, from that point, I fell in love with 10 meters. And and that's been 53 years ago. And I still haven't lost the love of that band.
Well, the thing of it is,
I like to call it the lower magic band. You know, 6 meters, they call it the magic band, but 10 meters has a lot of excitement, a lot of excitement.
Well, one thing about it, though, and of course you saw when Radio Shack manufactured a whole bunch of 10-meter radios, And most of those, the power level on them was, what, 5 to 10 watts or something like that. It just does not take very much power on 10 meters. When the band is open, you can work the world on 5 or 10 watts.
Well, they used to say, work the world with a wet noodle, literally.
Well, I use a early Kentec radio that has 5 watts output. It's a 509. And I have worked many, many foreign countries with
What kind of antenna
watts.
Do you use?
I'm using a 5-element monomander, but you can make the same type of contacts on 10 meters with a wire antenna, a dipole antenna. 10 meters is very forgiving for what we call poverty stations. In other words, basic stations. You can still purchase low-power radios for 10 meters. As the cycle progresses now, since we're heading into a new cycle, you will see more and more radios on the market that are specifically for 10 meters that are 25 watts or less.
And as far as building antennas are concerned, since what you call a quarter wavelength on 10 meters is about 8 feet, you put two of them back to back, you got a dipole, you can put a Yagi together, and usually it'd be not much bigger than a TV antenna.
And let's not forget that 10 meters is the widest HF band available to amateurs, so you not only get to work CW data modes like PSK31 and say that now the newest extreme low power, which is called Whisper, which only takes a few milliwatts to work stations all over the world. But you also have a sideband AM, FM. It's the only band that the HF band that has FM on it.
That you can do wideband FM on above 25 or 29.5.
Yes, yes. Yep.
And we have repeaters. Lisa, don't forget about the repeater operations above 2900.
That's fascinating. If you're familiar with a repeater, and we were talking about the satellites earlier, when you listen to an FM repeater on 10 meters, it could be 1,500 miles away, and it sounds like the guy's next door.
Well, exactly.
That's one of the advantages. When it's open, it's open. And another advantage we have are the beacons. 28150 to 28.3, you will find beacons that are controlled signals, CW signals, that are broadcast constantly, 24 hours a day, that you can use to check the conditions of the RF bands.
That's fascinating when you listen. When 10 meters is what you call open, you can dial between 28150 and 28.3 and hear several dozen CW signals, all identified. I happen to live down the street from a guy in Parma, Ohio, that has got one, so he pegs my meter there. But it's always on. What's he running, like maybe 5 watts or something like that? What's the power level of beacons?
Beacons are normally under 5 watts. There are a lot of beacons. There's several of them in South Africa that are running half watt. And I try to find those, because if you can hear those, you know the band's open.
Well, for those that don't know what a beacon is, it's just a station that transmits continuously, and if you can pick it up, the band's open.
Exactly. And for shortwave listeners, those beacon stations are also an indicator for them, because a lot of shortwave listeners who are not ham operators actually copy those call signs down, and they'll go after QSL cards. And it can be, some of those can be very coveted cards, because when you're talking about a half-watt station from South Africa, that's a prize.
Well, I worked Hong Kong on 5 watts on 10 meters, and I'm from Northwest Louisiana. So, 10 meters is forgiving. It doesn't take a lot. You don't have to invest a lot. It takes time, and it takes patience. It's just like anything else. If you want to go somewhere, you got to pay your dues.
So if you want to find out more about 1010 International, how does somebody go about that?
1010, either the numbers or spellitout.org on the net. We have a web page. We've had web service up since the early 80s, so we're there on the web.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of the Dayton Hamvention 2012, brought to you by Transworld Antennas and Ham Test Online. We'll be back with more of the Dayton broadcast right after
this.
One
of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, "Hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online." I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website, it's simply QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. And now, ladies and gentlemen, back to our rebroadcast of the Dayton Hamvention 2012, brought to you by Ham Test Online and Trans World Antennas. Now, you talked about the fact that the FCC had taken away the band back in that particular period of time, and then it allocated it to Citizens Band at that time. And by the way, I do want to tell folks that have just tuned in, you're listening to a live broadcast coming to you from the Dayton Hamvention 2012. And from just what little bit I've seen, looks like we've got a great crowd here this year. Looks like there's all kinds of folks here.
Beautiful weather.
I haven't been out to the flea market yet.
The weather today is great. For those who are coming to Dayton or thinking about coming to Dayton, and if you're on your way in, you're listening, the weather forecast for this weekend is going to be stellar. There is not going to be any rain. It's probably going to be in the 80s Fahrenheit. So if you really want to come out here and enjoy speaking to a lot of people from a lot of different countries, this is the place to do it. It's a worldwide event.
Or just get introduced for the first time ever to amateur radio, and the amateur radio as a hobby in all the facets of it.
Well, I want to mention, too, that this broadcast is being brought to you by Trans World Antennas, the company that makes the TW2010 and the 4040 and the 8080 and all those very unique antennas. They fold up, they go in a travel bag, and actually when they are set up and on the ground, they'll keep up with any three element beam on a 50 foot tower. I mean, I've watched this, seen it myself personally. And also, we also want to mention the folks at Ham Test Online that are on board with us during this broadcast. The question I was going to ask you, though, is, and we were talking about the thing with 11 meters. You know, I guess, you know, it's kind of like one of those things that it looks bad, but then you wind up kind of winning in the end. And what I mean by that is, how many radio amateurs today that are licensed that got their feet wet on 11 meters as a Citizens Band operator.
I'm one of those.
Yeah, well, I am too. I am too as well. So it's kind of like, you know, it looked like a curse at first, but then what a rich, fertile ground, you know, now, to get people into the hobby.
And what drew me into amateur radio, you know, from the Citizens Band was the fact that it was the organization of it. I mean, how much more organized it was, and how much more formal it was. But then again, it opened up opportunities for me that I never would have had had I stayed just on Citizens Band. Amateur radio gave me a speaking voice that I never did really have. I did some broadcasting work as a result of amateur doing some amateur work. So it's a good starting. You know, Citizens Band may have been a good starting point, but for me, it jump started me into several different modes, several different operations, and I met friends from all over the world that I never would have met if I had I stayed on Citizens Band. Citizens Band has its purpose and is a good operating mode, but to jump to amateur radio, to go ahead and go ahead and pick up the course on Ham Test Online, to go through that and actually go through those courses and get that license, and it's a coveted license. So those of us amateurs are amateur that get their licenses, they take care of the license and they take care of the people that are on that they talk to on the air.
Well, it's an interesting hobby in that it is a federally licensed hobby, and there just isn't much of that around anymore. Where else do you have to go? What other hobby is there that you have to have a license for, but you're proud to have a license for, especially, too, since you're allowed to transmit your own signal?
Exactly, and you're not limited by distance that you are on the Citizens Band. You're limited to 150 miles and a 60-foot high antenna.
Yeah, many people don't pay attention to that, but it's encouraged.
But distance is encouraged. Different modes are encouraged. Experimentation is encouraged. It's a whole different world of operations.
It's more than just communication.
When I was a kid, the Citizens Band was, it was different, a lot different than it is now. But you were only allowed to talk to someone who had a different call sign on channels 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, and 14. And I think channel 23, that was it. You were limited there. You could talk to someone else who had a different call sign on those channels only. There was a no chit-chat rule. Now, what exactly that meant, I don't know. It said no chit-chat. Well, you could define chit-chat as anything, you know. But it was supposed to discourage people from getting on and talking to another licensed Citizens Bander and just shooting the breeze. Okay, so
now, later when I got on amateur radio, which was in the 1970s, now it had already progressed and it was very popular because you saw it on television. So teenagers like myself went, "Oh, that's a great mode! I want to get into that." And at the time, you had to obtain a license for it. Of course, it was free, but you had to obtain a license for it. And later, as I grew older, and I thought, I want something different. There's got to be more than just this.
Well, the limitations were pretty bold because they told you, they said if you were on for 5 minutes, you had to observe a 5 minute silent period. So if you talked for 5 minutes, you had to shut up for 5 minutes. You couldn't talk for 5 minutes, and you could not talk to anyone with a different call sign other than on those assigned channels. They were very specific: 5 watts in, 4 watts out, and no communications over 150 miles. Period. Those were the rules.
And when you jump to amateur radio, all those restrictions, a lot of those restrictions went away. All of a sudden, you've got 1,500 watts of power that you can work with, which only a few percentage of people actually use. Okay, because I do communication with just a few watts on a small antenna with some digital modes and talk all over the world with it. So you get fewer restrictions, but then you open up different modes of communications that just aren't available to you. And experimentation, you can build your own equipment. There's a lot of satisfaction in just building something and getting it on the air and saying, wow.
But one thing 11 meters has done, and that is you will see these situations Where I live, I got a telephone call from the airport, who was not too far away, and he had got my name. The fellow called me, got my name through someone else. And he said, we're having a real problem. We just don't know what to do. And I said, so we went over to look. I went to look to see what his problem was. His problem was right on the borderline of the airport was about a 125-foot tower with what would be called dual Moonraker antennas, which were, I mean, these look like cubicle quads, you know. There's two of them on there, stacked, you know. And the guy was running, he's running a couple kilowatts, maybe more, you know, I don't know. I mean, I just know he had a metal ceramic tube that was bigger than a 3CX1500, let's put it that way. And that's what he was running on the air. So the question is, you know, if a person to be that serious and to spend that kind of money and to go to that kind of trouble, why in the world would they not want to just go ahead and get a ham license? You know, because, I mean, you're...
And expand their opportunities.
Yeah, you put the money into a tower and an antenna and an amplifier that size and probably only knows how much he spent for his radio. And he's limited to one band. That's all he can operate, just that one band. And then,
he's taking
course,
a chance on getting caught and prosecuted, too.
Right.
Exactly.
And what about this? I was asking this question. The big thing became, and this is after I got out of it years ago, because when I was in it, it was a very tame thing, was the out-of-band operation. In other words, going above, what do they do? Do they go above Citizens Band or do they go below Citizens Band?
Both.
Okay. So, I mean, is that still something that's prevalent that's going on now, or is that kind of died down some?
No, it hasn't, actually.
It's still there. It's limited to certain parts of the country. Where you have major interstate systems on the highways, you will find a lot of activity.
It's not just the United States anymore. Finding activity coming out of South America that is Citizens Band related, that have encroached into the 10-meter ham band. So it's not just the United States anymore.
Well, we used to listen. Yeah, because it is encroaching into the ham band on certain channels, because there are certain things you can do to radios that will make them transmit on the 10-meter band fairly easily.
I remember we used to listen to, I think maybe this was in band on Citizens Band, and everybody was telling me these guys were shrimp fishermen or shrimp boats or something
in South Louisiana.
But those guys would get on, and they must have been running amplifiers or something. But I mean, the language would cut the air. Let's put it that way. You know, and they were quite vocal. You know, and I just remember that a long time back. That was very unusual to hear something like that on air. You just did not hear it on the air. But now, somebody was telling me something to the effect of the fact that there is a lot of activity with large equipment, single sideband operating above and below the Citizens Band.
A lot of it below the Citizens Band is AM activity. And above Citizens Band, it's single sideband. And where you run into it, now they will be running AM a lot of times in the 28 megahertz band in the places where we have PSK, where we have CW, where we have RTTY operation or RTTY operations. And some people say, well, this is why we have so many CW operators that have moved back to 10 meters, to discourage this type of activity. And it is true. We have a tremendous population using continuous wave Morse code on 10 meters in the recent years. A lot of it is amateur radio operators do not appreciate the encroachment on something that they earned through license, and the attitude of some of the other operators from the other bands are, well, you can't regulate RF.
But again, it's one of the use it or lose it aspects, and that's why 1010 is active as it is. They want to use the band, use it correctly, and.
I was going to say, one thing, though, I could see this some time ago, and that was the way Citizens Band was set up, and the number of people that went out and bought radios and bought antennas and amplifiers and everything out of the sun and banned the use of call letters and everybody had a nickname.
Everybody wanted to be a Smokey the Bandit.
You know, but nobody wanted it. I mean, and way before Smokey and the Bandit, they were under using handles. I mean, I remember lived in the Detroit area, and I remember all those guys getting on, and there were people that used handles like Kingfish and Irishman and the Professor, and I'm Sparky. I mean, I used all these names. You know, well, of course that made it necessary then if the commission wanted to go do something to these people. They had to triangulate and track them down because, you know, if they use their call letters, well, of course, they could be found and nailed. But if they weren't using call sign, it made it a lot more difficult. And but what I could see is that the amount of growth in Citizens Band, especially now when we went through the urban cowboy stage in country music, and then the Smokey and the Bandit thing came out, and then the truck drivers all started taking to Channel 19 on Citizens Band. There was a growth of that thing. It was just all those CB songs, C.W. McCall and all that stuff. It really and truly mushroomed. And I could see then it was completely out of control. I could see then there was no way the FCC could possibly have a handle on this. This thing had gotten so big that the commission couldn't control it. So what did they do? They dropped the licensing fee. They dropped the license. You didn't have to have a license. You just go to Walmart, buy a radio, stick it in your car, and you're good to go. You know, so it changed radically. So instead of fighting City Hall, so to speak, they just gave up on it. All right, now it's declined since then. Of course, there's not the activity on it that there used to be. I understand truck drivers, you know, still use it quite a bit on Channel 19, traveling across country and whatnot. But I guess what I saw at that point was there was an area and a group of people that wanted to be on the radio. They wanted to learn about radio and two-way communications. But honestly, I think maybe the ham test itself at that time and the way ham radio was being approached was a little bit too difficult. I mean, I know a lot of folks that they could pass the technical exams, couldn't pass code. Somehow that code would just hang them up. You know, I mean, they just couldn't get past that code. Now, people I knew that were musicians, boy, they could breeze that code all the way through without a problem at all. It wasn't a problem for me, but I know folks I tried personally to teach the code that I thought had the aptitude, and I wound up throwing my hands up in the air and saying, they just can't get this.
There's a knack to it that not everybody has. Most people do.
Okay, but when they dropped the code and they went down to the technical side of radio as being just the technical the license for the technician, especially the technician being the entry level, now all of a sudden there has been a tremendous growth in amateur radio. And some of the older fellows are a little resentful, and he's doggone no code generals getting on here and talking on the radio.
That's true. But then again, there has also been a resurgence as of late of no code technician plus and general class hams who have taken up CW as a new mode because it was something that was fascinating to them. So they're doing it on their own now, and there has actually been a growth in CW.
Well, I mean, we see. I mean, I know I talked to one year we were, I guess it was probably at the Huntsville Ham Fest. We were right next door to Vibroplex, and I talked to the original owners of Vibroplex. They said, "Yeah, we're selling a lot more now that they lifted the code requirement. We're selling more bugs and keys and all that." And I thought, that's pretty strange. And then when I talked to, I think it was Gordon West, said they were selling the code training materials a lot more than they were back when it was a requirement. So that's true. However, I've noticed if I get on the 75 meter band at night, late at night, and start dialing down the dial back and forth, I can go all the way from 3600 all the way to the bottom of the band and not hear one
very little activity sometimes.
Yeah,
yes,
absolutely nobody. You know, and I remember in the novice days, you could go from 3,700 to 3,750, and there was always somebody in there. You know, that's disappointing. I think the other thing that's a little disappointing.
I think the disappointing aspect you're seeing there is what's happened to amateur radio in general. Because I look at on a lot of the bands, and there's several spots there where they're quiet and where they never used to be, and a lot of amateur radio operators, myself included, spend a lot of time on the internet instead of on the radio. And it's sad, but that's actually some of the things that's happening. There's other activities that are drawing us away from our amateur radio activities that would normally put us on the band. That now the bands are a little bit more quiet, and you can actually find a quiet spot on the band. It's sad, but there are amateurs out there that doing.
Well, the other night I was on 75, and I just started tuning up the dial, and I must have found 8, 9, 10 roundtable groups. I guess I want to say I'd say groups, not roundtables, but groups that were on talking, shooting the breeze. Around 3980, there was some AM activity going on and whatnot. Okay, so in other words, all that's going on, and I went down to look for some CW, and there was nothing there, just absolutely dead. But the other thing, too, I think one thing that discourages some folks is the fact that if they want to get on and go slow, let's say they don't have, they can't do 30 words a minute. Maybe they can't even do... They can't even do 20. Maybe their top speed is 10 words a minute. I think a lot of folks are afraid or maybe embarrassed to get on and operate at those speeds. And that was one thing that the novice license did. It gave you the excuse to be slow. So you could get on and move slow, and you felt okay about sending slow CW.
Well, there are some blogs out there and some things in our magazines that say give the break to the person who's just trying to learn the CW or just getting on there and make them feel him or her feel comfortable that they don't have to burn along at 25 words a minute in order to have an effective QSO.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of the Dayton Hamvention 2012, brought to you by Transworld Antennas and Ham Test Online. We'll be back with more of the Dayton broadcast right after this. In this day and time, what we don't have much of is time. And if you enjoy operating and you just don't get a chance to, you need to take a look at the Transworld Antennas TW2010 and all the models that operate the different bands. Go to YouTube and put in Transworld Antennas and see how simple this thing is to set up. I mean, it is easy. It goes together fast. And, of course, that gives you more time to operate. You're not fussing around with an antenna. In an emergency situation, it is absolutely necessary. You need to have one of these. If not for yourself, for your club, or whoever it is that may get called out on a scene where you've got to operate and you've got to be able to set up quickly and efficiently. Go to their website, and that's transworldantennas.com, transworldantennas.com. There's a link up there to YouTube, and you can see how quickly this antenna sets up, how easy it is to operate. transworldantennas.com. This reminder from PrayForMe.us. If you have a need in your life and you need someone to pray for you, go to the website PrayForMe.us. That's PrayForMe.us. You can remain anonymous, use a nickname, or just your first name. There's no financial requirements and no personal information needed. It's just people praying for people. If you have a need, go to PrayForMe.us. That's PrayForMe.us. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSOradioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. And now, ladies and gentlemen, back to our rebroadcast of the Dayton Hamvention 2012, brought to you by Ham Test Online and Transworld Antennas.
Well, that's something I'm going to have to get myself back into is to relearn CW. I took it and got my Tech Bus license, And unfortunately, I had a very bad experience with my very first CW contact. I did it on 2 meters, and it just happened to be during a VHF sweep contest. And I made a contact with a relatively local amateur extra, and he was just whipping the stuff back at me at better than 30 words a minute. And I haven't done CW since. It left a bad taste in my mouth. But I know that there are operators out there that are going to be much more patient and actually slow down. I mean, he didn't, but that's one thing I do want to stress to, especially those amateur extras and generals that are listening that have gotten that have had their CW proficiencies for decades, is that please slow down for the guys who are learning the first time. Be patient and teach them to do CW the correct way.
Well, there's also an advantage to knowing CW as well. You're talking about earlier the beacons on 10 meters. Many of the repeater identifiers are in CW. I know my son and his wife are both no-code techs, and they say, where's that repeater? I say, well, there's the call sign. There's where it is. He says, I got to learn the code.
Well, that's the advantage of the beacons. And as was mentioned earlier, the novice portions of the CW areas, any operator, no matter what their license class, if you went there, you understood that you need to operate slow CW because that's what you were going to find there. Now that we don't have the CW requirement and we don't have those portions anymore, there are times when you run into problems with CW operators that are what we call barn burners that are going 35 words a minute. I normally broadcast at 15 words a minute on 10 meters. If someone comes back to me at 20 words a minute, I will elevate. If they come back to me at 7 words a minute, I will degenerate. I want to make a contact. I don't want to impress anyone with my ability to send or receive CW.
What's the cue signal for slow down, please? I can't remember that right now.
Well, normally you end up with a bunch of question marks or a bunch of E's. And when you see that, you say, well, I'll shift gears. I will turn the overdrive off and I will slow down.
On 10 meters, you're talking now, let's get back to the 1010 International. We've got the sunspots coming back somewhat now. 10 meters isn't as active reflectively, I guess, from the atmosphere as we've seen in some sunspot cycles gone by. But hopefully they'll continue to climb for another year or two. What are some of the things that you look forward to on 10 meters and like the things that the 1010 International operators are doing?
Well, we have over 100 chapters worldwide in different parts. I have a lot of friends in Germany. And at 1,500 UTC in the morning, they will hold their chapter nets. These local organizations get together and they will rag chew. And with the band like it is on less than 100 watts, I can talk to those people in the mornings, and that's something I look forward to. I mentioned to one of them, I said, well, it's been 9 years since I've spoken to you, and I mentioned that here recently. But it's the same thing. It's been many years since I've talked to some people in Oregon. And in my part of the country, we only get to work Japan for a very short period of time. Sorry to say, that period of time has transpired, so it'll be about 11 years before I can work Japan again. But when the band was there, it didn't take anything to work those stations. They were extremely loud, easy to work.
Look, it's going back to what Sam said here about 10 being almost like the second magic band. Because when it opens up, it can surprise.
It's almost like magic. It's just like 6 meters, and it's just like a magic band all its own. It comes to life. You make a lot of contacts. You meet a lot of friends on the air. And it can be worldwide. It could be statewide. And the bands can change instantly. But when it's really open, it's a lot of fun.
Sometimes you'll hear the CW beacons and hear nobody on the air. It's like, you know, hey, give a shout. Somebody.
Oh, that's when you start making your own activity and start calling CQ.
Yeah, I mean, there were times when and you were talking about Sam how the activity seems to have tapered off somewhat over the years, and I've noticed that quite a bit since I've been licensed for like almost 53 years now. In the early '60s, listening to like 40 and 75 meter phone, especially on the weekends in the middle of the morning, it sounded almost like what contests sound like now. It was wall-to-wall stations. It is so much more open now. It's almost easier to make contacts now than it was 20, 30, 40 years ago. Because
I believe it is.
As you mentioned earlier, there's other activities that we do. Somebody will check their email before they flip on the radio. Yeah. I mean, for me, it was, you know, get up in the morning, turn on the radio.
Yeah, but these days, I mean, for amateur operators that you know, that may not be so patient, I mean, when you turn on the radio and you find the band a little bit dead, don't be afraid to create activity. You never know when something's going to be out there and the band be open, and all of a sudden you're making a bunch of contacts. You might be the DX station.
Well, you might be the root of the dog pile, as we call it, because a lot of times people listen. You cannot make a contact with your ear.
Yeah, if everybody's listening and nobody's talking, nobody knows if the band's open.
Yeah. Don't be afraid to call CQ and put your call sign out there.
If you hear a beacon, say something.
You know, that's one of the things I've noticed, and that is a lot of guys will go up and down the band, and this is true, very true on 75 at night. They go up and down the band, they'll find a QSO. They jump in. And sometimes the guys are not that friendly. I mean, they're in there. I mean, face it. We're a bunch of old geezers, okay? We're in there talking to our buddies.
Want to name a few frequencies on 75 yet or not?
I
won't do that.
Here comes some guy who says, I just got me a new microphone, and I want to know how it sounds. So, and, of course, he has a voice that would make, you know, fingers on a chalkboard sound pleasing, you know? And so, you know, you want to be...
remember chalkboards.
Yeah, you want to go back to the guy and be courteous and whatnot. But a lot of folks jump in the middle of QSOs, and they're not received well. And sometimes even get harassed, you know. But I guess what I'm saying is what needs to happen is you just sit, you know, move down the dial.
Change the tune. That's why we're one of the few services that does not have an assigned channel frequency.
But get on and call
most of our bands.
Call CQ. Start a CQ and just start calling until you get someone that answers. And when you get someone that answers, I'll tell you what will happen. If you engage in a conversation, and this is something else I've noticed, it seems like in amateur radio, one of the things we've really missed out on and we're lacking now, and that's the ability for people to actually talk. Now, I'm sitting here watching you guys go, okay? Now, I can't get a word in edgewise, you know, and I'm the show host, but I don't care because this is all interesting.
I'm waiting for you to throw me out of here. That's what you get, two broadcasters going at each other. Well, see, we just did it just now.
Now, interesting stuff to listen to, but by the same token, there's a lot of folks on air, on ham radio, that I would say are conversationally challenged. The old rag chew part of it seems to be going away. And that's one of the things I will have to say, is we have concentrated so much on emergency communication and all that kind of stuff, we've kind of ignored the fun part of it. And I think rag chewing is one of those things that makes ham radio fun. Well, on top of that, if you travel around the country, and even if you get on Echolink, you find so many of these repeaters that are just not occupied. I go through an area, and I'll get on, give my call sign. Nobody answers. Go to another machine, same thing.
Yep.
You know, and this is all across the country. Now, I know for a fact there are people sitting there that's got radios on, and they're hearing you. But they're just not inclined to talk.
One of the things that I did at one of our two-meter repeater clubs was, everybody knows there I'm a broadcaster and been doing this for many, many years, and I said, do you mind if I get on, because like you'll get on 2 meters or something and say, like my call sign, W8IXY, listening on 7-6, and nobody comes back. So I said, what if I got on there and did a little bit of a shtick before that, like saying, hello, testing CQ. Oh, no, I can't call CQ. This is W8IXY listening. Wait, but if I'm listening, I'm not expecting. And this, I'm talking to the whole time, just like I am now. But then nobody's going to come back. I'll carry on with that little bit of shtick for 10 or 15 seconds. More often than not, somebody will call back and say, hey, I didn't think I was going to pick up the microphone, but I picked it up to say hi to you. And that gets it going, and then you can get more people going. That doesn't work just on 2 meters, though.
It works.
It'll work on any band.
Yeah.
Well, see, do something interesting. Yeah.
Well, that person that starts that, and you'll get QSO.
One of the things on Echolink, and that is in bold print, you will see on a lot of the repeaters you're checking into, it says call CQ. It says in print, call CQ. And I thought, yeah, but on many, many of the local machines, if you call CQ, they act like, you know, you got leprosy or something.
Oh, no, it's better like when, you know, because I've got the tower on my hat. I said, you know, I'm the tower hat man. I'm listening for some contacts. And you'd be surprised how many people would actually come back to that and
you,
talk
you
to
got,
talk
you. You got to break that ice.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Even if it's ghost talking, that's what we call it. You know, you sit there and you carry on for 5 minutes and talking to yourself, and someone will come back and say, are you okay?
Yeah, but you could literally, you could start drawing something out of a person. You get them to answer you, you know, what'd you have for breakfast today? Do you do basket weaving, or do you write microprocessor code? You know, how do you, you know, do you like fishing, hunting? Would you rather ride a motorbike? You know, have you ever flown an airplane?
And
you could go.
It's the way to meet people. It's the way to meet people, to get to know the people. When you start asking, you know, what do you do for a living? And all these kind of things. And you get the conversations going. And this is what the rag chew element is. You get the conversations going, and keep them going, and then all of a sudden you may have two or three people in on the conversation.
Somebody break. I heard you talking about something. That's happened a number of times to me. I heard you talking about something that sounds interesting, so I thought I'd jump in. And you make them feel welcome.
Exactly. Always to make them feel welcome. Yeah. Always make them feel come on and come back to you.
We are officially out of time for today. Just one of those things that happens on the radio. But I do want to say this, and that is that today's broadcast has been brought to you by two companies that are absolutely fantastic. The first one that I want to tell you about is Transworld Antennas. And Transworld Antennas makes the TW2010, a portable antenna that is stealth. You can go to their website, which is transworldantennas.com. And, you know, we've had these things, so we're real experienced with them. Matter of fact, if you go up on YouTube and put in Transworld Antennas, you will see my my older son, David, assembling one of these things and tearing it down. And I think it takes him maybe 2 minutes to do both operations. But that that antenna operates 10 meters down to 20 meters and everything in between. And it has a little control box you switch through. They make another one called the Backpacker, which is the same antenna minus the control box. And they make the 4040, which is a single band 40-meter antenna, and an 80-meter antenna that's basically the same. These things fold up. By the way, these are excellent on 10 meters. They're absolutely incredible on 10 meters. But you can actually, they fold it up, goes in a bag. But yet, when it's placed on the ground, and this is uncanny. I've watched this. I had my Zep antenna going on open wire line into a Johnson kilowatt matchbox, and the TW2010 on 20, on 17 meters, and on 10 meters, it will eat the dipole's lunch. You know, I think it has to do with the angle of radiation. It actually does better in some cases. We've had it set up side by side with a three-element beam on a 50-foot tower, and it would be neck to neck at all points, with never the beam having an advantage over the thing, which I thought was kind of unusual. But nonetheless, it's a great antenna. They are bringing you this radio broadcast. Go to their website, transworldantennas.com, and in addition to that, Ham Test Online. And these folks are fantastic. If you know someone, and right now, if you've taken this test, and you passed the test, and you did it through the study of a Ham Test Online, one of the things that you can do, because the Ham Test Online program is so reasonably priced, and that is buy a membership of Ham Test Online for they're about $20, and give it to a young person. And encourage them to do the studying and to take the test and pass and get the ticket. This is, I guess I want to say, fundamental to the hobby. If you think you're a poor Elmer and you just couldn't quite, you don't think you could really quite help someone get a license, then give them a membership. Because $20, you got, what is it, a two-year membership? You got 2 years to pass the test. They got all and the study material, the way it's presented through Ham Test Online is just really unique. So go up to their website, hamtestonline.com, and take a look at that program that they have set up there. And if you're looking to get your ticket, that's the way to go. It really is. I know so many folks that have gotten tickets through Ham Test Online. They say, and they, when they get done, they swear by the program. And on top of that, if you have a ticket, this is a good gift to give to some prospective young person or even an old person that wants to get their ticket. You know, give them a subscription to Ham Test Online. Hey, we're coming to you live. This is Dayton 2012 Hamvention in Dayton, Ohio. And, wow, I've been out in the flea market walking around, and I don't need to be out there because there's too many nostalgic things, too many things. You know, a fellow told me the other day, get right up on that mic if you can. The guy told me that, he says, what that flea market's for, really, is for us old guys to go out and visit our old equipment that we used to have.
Memories.
Alan Pitts is with me, and Alan is the public relations manager for the American Radio Relay League. He and I have been working together for quite some time, and I'm one of his biggest admirers because he can get all these guys together that have all these... Hams are the ones that have the most radically different opinions and all this kind of stuff. You get them all together on one roof playing ball on the same team.
And we're having absolutely too much fun. I mean, too much levity in this whole thing. This should not be allowed.
So tell me, this year... What has been the league's focus on? Usually every year, but he takes a different kind of a different theme or whatever.
Well, the biggest thing this year is we came out initially with the DIY video, which is a short, about 8.5 minute video that was put on. I came up with the concept. Dave Bell, Bill Pasternak were the two biggest people that actually helped make it happen. And with the outreach, we recognize the growth of DIY and makers communities, hacker groups all throughout the United States, and got a fast little bit of an education myself when a number of these people, we're hackers. And I go, this is a bad thing. I'm not so sure about this. And I found out, the term has really changed. It's not what I thought it was, the malicious use of computers. It just means doing cool stuff.
Well, yeah, and I've talked to folks that are into, I guess I'm going to say, HR, different companies responsible for hiring the IT section of their company, and it's weird because now, instead of folks looking necessarily for college-degreed IT people, they look for hackers, people who are really into,
creative, yeah, imaginative, and figure... I mean, they're natural hams. I mean, they figure out how to... We want to accomplish this. We'll find a way to do it. And there's so much overlap between the two communities, and yet there actually is little integration between the two that ARL and I talked about it, and we decided to do a special outreach to the maker and hacker people. So we created the video and really been working very, very hard to get to Makers Fairs and other places where we've got these different groups and representatives from the groups, and put out the information that there's all kinds of neat things you can do with amateur radio, and also tell the hams there's all kinds of neat things these guys are doing over there. So that's the big theme for this year and the major push. Now here at Dayton, we've got a whole stage full, and I've got one going every hour of different presentations, people that are amateur radio people, but are doing all kinds of maker-hacker things with Arduino chips, doing EME on a shoestring, working with microcontrollers, all kinds of neat things. And I have been very, very pleased because over there, every one of these presentations so far, when we started yesterday, we had five of them yesterday, and we've already gone through two of them today. Every seat in that area has been taken, and they're usually four deep standing.
Well, I've got a grandchild that's been hanging out over there at the ARL booth. He's 8 years old, and we brought him in here, and he like vanishes. He goes right straight over to the ARL booth because you guys have got things for kids over there.
Oh yeah,
and he is just totally taken by all this, you know. So we were thinking about maybe having him take the test to get the ham license. this time around, but it may have been over his head. But he didn't want to miss all the fun with all the kids because he's getting a chance to play with all the rest of these kids and work with them and learn with them and all the activities. An incredible thing.
They have a whole lot of fun over there in that youth area, and truthfully, I don't know of any other place in Dayton's Hamvention that there is a place for kids. So if, you know, somebody comes with their parents or whatever, where else do they go? But they head there, true. And they have fun.
We've got Martin Jew that just sat down. Have you met Martin by any chance?
I not only have met him, I remember him for his kindness, his generosity, and being one heck of a gentleman at a time when we needed him. Now, I'm going to tell you a story about this guy.
Uh-oh. Are you ready for this now?
You got to go.
I don't know. We'll see what he says.
You got to go back 6 years. And this is a little bit personal on the thing. But if you remember, there was a whole series of hurricanes. Florida got hit by 3 of them in 1 year. And, okay, fine. And the hams were very, very active. But then come about December, I learned that many of the families that the hams had been working with and helping, many of them were still living in homeless shelters with their kids and still living in shelters. And I talked to Dave Sumner, God love him, the chief executive officer for ARL. And just my way of thinking, we got to do something about this. Now, ARL had never done anything like it before, but that year we pulled the toy drive. And we asked amateur radio people from around the country if you can send money, because I set up things where we could buy toys really cheaply or get toys donated. And we brought them all together. If I remember right, I think it was Memphis we brought them together in. And then, okay, so we had warehouses in Memphis. And then the question was, okay, how do we get them from Memphis down to Florida? I had found a voluntary organization called the White Dove down there, which was a non-profit and had been working with the children all through that area. And they knew the kids, they knew the families, and there were hundreds of kids down there that were still living in shelters. And so we got to play Santa Claus, and I found one crazy old gentleman who had a couple of trucks, who was actually willing to turn those trucks and have his trucks drive those toys from Memphis all the way down to Florida. And that gentleman happens... I appreciate it. I still appreciate it, Martin.
Well, I appreciate y'all asking us, and we were just happy to do it.
Now, he's also been real good with hurricanes and where we've hit and needed some equipment and things. He's been real fast on that, but that's the first I met you, and that's not forgotten.
Well, that's very nice of you.
This is a Southern gentleman, if ever there was one. Not a question on that. So anyway, the ARL has been known to do some strange things at times, but hopefully for the good.
I always love talking to Martin, and one of the reasons why is because years ago, I had bought a Drake TR3, it didn't have a CW filter in it. And someone said, well, you need to get one of these MFJ CW filters, you know. And I bought one, and I went inside the radio, and I disconnected the audio line, and I stuck it in series of the audio lines. When I flipped it on, you know, it went through the speaker system. I didn't have to listen to the headphones. And it was an audio, very narrow band filter, that this man designed and built. And I think at that time they sold for $19.95, I think, or something like that.
Well, that was pretty close. I think the kit version of it was $9.95. And Ted, you don't look old enough to have bought the first one.
But I did, you know. And, boy, I mean, it was narrow. Yeah, I mean, you'd flip that thing on, and I mean, it was right on down there. And that was the best thing with that little TR3 for CW. Did you ever do anything like that, Alan?
No, I haven't. But he's designed so dang many good things, which I do got. I mean, I've got a bunch of his stuff. We got to get you one of those Ask Me Why I DIY buttons for your shirt there.
Yeah. Well, that'd be nice.
Well, I was going to say with Alan here, the most amazing thing. Now, you know, Martin, because you deal with amateurs all the time. I mean, they call on the telephone and they buy a piece of equipment, and I'm sure a lot of them fuss and, you know. That's just our nature. We hams love to fuss about something.
Oh, you know? And some people need more hand-holding than others, and that's okay.
But one of the things that Alan does with the league, and that is that he has to somehow bring all this together, whether it's all these different groups, all these different people, and wind up promoting the league and promoting the hobby at the same time. So he and I have worked together off and on for a long time, and I have had a chance to observe him. And it's quite amazing, the diplomat he is. Of course, now he has a background for this because he came.
found out about it. Too.
He came out of First off, he came out of a ministry situation.
Right.
So you were, you know,
ordained Lutheran pastor.
Yeah. So you know,
for years.
So what a better person to do public relations for the league than an ordained Lutheran minister who can keep all the Indians tame. You know, this is like missionary work, you know, is what it is.
Well, there's a lot of similarities.
So, but I really I appreciate you stopping by. I know you're just busier than
there's stuff going on. The one thing, you know, which I will mention at this particular point, and your audience will probably have at least some familiarity with what's going on. As you know, within the United States, there's two different types of laws. There is the actual government rules, regulations, and then there is what's called contract law. And amateur radio has a law, the PRB1 regulations, which limit the government zoning, building restrictions that things can put on to make it so that amateur radio at least has to be reasonably accommodated. And you can't have a city or a county government turn around and wipe it out and say, oh, no, you can't build antennas here. But at the same time, there are a lot of homeowners associations who have what is called CCNR or covenant law. And this is actually a contract which is oftentimes built up. CCNRs were found being required by the government people, the county or the city, before you can even develop a piece of property, before you can even build houses on that property. And one of the things that happened recently is the United States Congress told the Federal Communications Commission that they wanted them to do a fast study on, are all these CCNRs getting to be as bad as we think they might be? And what is its effect on emergency communications and the capabilities of amateur radio in emergencies? And they had 180 days to do it. Well, the FCC, as will happen, being a bureaucracy, it took a little while before they even got around at it. But meanwhile, this 180-day clock was ticking. Now, once they did release the inquiry, the ARRL went and polled our members, and we got thousands of responses, and I personally went through about 2,000 of those responses, and will admit that I was shocked that how many people are really under a restrictive area, and they do not have a chance. It's not a voluntary contract. There was never any negotiation across the table about the CCNR. It was you sign here or goodbye, and a lot of these people can't move to another state, another county, another territory. It's the only thing that's there. So anyway, ARRL ultimately did a survey, put it all together into a report that goes back to the FCC, and that was done this past week. Now, what happens there? Well, first of all, I got to admit, I am very, very proud of that ARRL report. If you read the thing, it's 130 some odd pages long, but if you just read the first 48, the main argument, it reads like a novel. It lays out the argument. Absolutely wonderful. I don't like legalese language, but I've never read anything that is quite as clear and as nice as that. But where does it go? We submitted it back to the FCC. The FCC has now closed their inquiry. The FCC will choose what it wants, and they will make their report back to Congress. And what Congress does with it from there, we do not know. For the simple reason, I don't know what Congress is going to do this year, if anything.
Does anyone
know? No, I don't think so. The point being, though, this was the one opportunity. Well, chances of anything happening actually are rather small. If the ARRL did not file like it did, the chances of anything happening would have been zero. We can't promise anything's going to happen. We don't know. It's not in our hands. But we kept alive the possibilities. And that's the part of the power of the ARRL. They do good. They really try to help all of amateur radio, not just any particular one little segment or one little population of it. And we promote all of amateur radio. And that's part of my job.
You know, I'll tell you, and a lot of folks don't realize all the stuff that goes on behind the scenes. That's the problem. We just, you know, we just don't know. We don't hear about it, you know. And some of it at the time, I guess, when it's going on, you really can't publicize it. It's something you can't really, you know, get in the middle of, I guess I want to say. It almost has to get down the road a fur piece before that, as we say in Tennessee, you know, before.
Well, I'll give you an example of that. Okay, we're coming up to our centennial. Okay, what is going to be the theme or the slogan for the centennial? Now, if I turn that, and I've been asked to work on that. If I turn that loose to the membership, 158,000 people are going to come back at me with 158,000 possibilities and answers, and some of them will be good, and some of them will be off the wall, and some of them will be past Pluto. And if you think I'm really going to be able to evaluate 158,000 things, you're crazy. Okay? So, how we do it and how we're going to go about it is I take a select group, officers, the public relations committee, things like that, and get about 40 people to give me their best ideas. And then from those, I'll bring it down to, 12, 15 of them, then turn that loose to the membership and say, hey, what do you think about these 12? Put them in order. Which ones do you like? That's manageable. Now, is that restricting the membership input? To some extent, yes. But it makes it doable. It makes it livable for everybody. So, in some ways, you're correct. You got to be a little further down the road and at least know which direction you're going before you turn everything loose sometimes.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Well, what's on the agenda here? Where are you headed and what...
I'm going to be headed back to that ARRL DIY stage. We got 8 presentations today, they've been good. Right now I've got Mark Cram covering for me so I could come over and say hi. But I got to head back there and having a whole lot of fun learning and listening myself.
Well, we've had, we've just had an awful lot of... we've had a lot of activity in terms of hams coming by here that have not been to Dayton before, that are new to the license, so just getting the license and whatnot. And I guess I've been kind of amazed because a lot of them have got shortwave radios. A lot of them are buying HF equipment, you know, because you would think that the new licensees would be focused on VHF. You know, they're buying HF stuff, you know.
Yep.
So they're preparing to get, you know, to get...
They're looking at upgrading.
Going down the road a little further, you know. So I think that, I guess I want to say you've got your work cut out for you because you've got this whole new young group of folks that are coming on board that are just not familiar with what's going on. And somehow they have to get acquainted with all this. And they got to have a reason why they visit Martin Jew's website and get those antenna analyzers and antennas and amplifiers.
Those things are one. That was the best product you've ever come out with, is that antenna analyzer.
Well, we've had, I'll tell you, if that's the way it's been with me, and I'll tell you what else, we've actually used it on the FM broadcast band to take a quick look at 10 bay broadcast antennas, and I wish the thing went down into the AM broadcast band arena because that would really help a lot, you know, but can't have everything, you know.
We'll have one.
The other thing is, at some point in time, I would really like to talk to some of the fellas that man W1AW. And talk about
Joe Carcio.
Yeah, all the different things that run on W1AW. Now, that's published in the magazine, but I get people asking me all the time, what's on W1AW? You know, I said, well, there's bulletins, there's code practice, and there are people that visit, that come by there and get on the air and actually talk on the thing and communicate with people. I said, it's smart.
Yeah, the guy you want to talk with is named Joe Carcio, and he's not here because he's running W1AW.
Yeah, well, we'll have to meet up with him at some point in time. We plan on coming to Newington with our setup.
Look forward to it.
If y'all have us, you know, and
look forward to it.
And broadcasting from there, as well as we want to go down to Martin's place too. And,
that'd be fun too.
Oh gosh, I could get lost in there, you know, with all the things. But I really appreciate you coming by and taking.
Well, it's been fun to stop in. You take care.
You do the same. I appreciate you taking that, and I know how busy you are. So, Martin Jew, I'm so elated you've come by to talk to us. I'm trying to turn down the extra microphones here.
Okay, well,
get rid of some of the crowd noise.
Well, I appreciate you asking me to come and talk to you.
Oh my goodness, it's the highlight of our Dayton show to get you over here because. I don't know. I mean, I just think that, you know, I look at all the companies that are here, everybody here, and I mean, there's some people put out some really good stuff, and there's a lot of really good radio companies, accessory companies. But listen, you know what? You've won it hands down, man. I mean, there's more stuff. Yeah, my favorite CW paddle is one of yours. I don't even know what model it is. I just know it has a stainless steel base.
Oh, yeah.
And, absolutely love the thing, and I've tried I don't know how many different ones, and of course I think with those things it comes down to the feel. It's like what feels good to you.
I think so, and that's a pretty personal thing, you know. As I was driving, or as we were driving from Mississippi up to the Dayton Hamvention, I was operating CW with 1 watt on 40 meters with a 8-foot telescope and whip antenna in the loading car. That was a lot of fun to make QRP contacts.
Now, were you driving? CW.
No, I wasn't driving.
But by the same token, you know, I've got friends of mine that strap keys on their legs and do CW in their head while they're driving. I mean, and they can do that mm-hmm. for some reason. I can barely think about where is the turn signal indicator.
I know that's the way I am. But I have operated CW and driven at the same time. Just have to be a little careful when doing that.
Okay, now on 1 watt, you were running 1 watt. Were you running a key or a straight key or?
No, this was an electronic key. It's one of the ones that's similar to the one that you used. But, you know, 40 meters is pretty difficult to operate sideband with that low power. But CW, you know, you can make plenty of contacts that way.
Just give me an example. You were running 1 watt. Now, what kind of rig was that?
It was one of our new QRP rigs. It's the 9214. Let's see. I believe that's the right number. But it's one that has a digital readout, and it covers bands from 80 meters through 15 meters by using plug-in modules. It's a nice, easy rig to use. In fact, I was using pin light cells that was inside the radio.
Okay. But tell me about your contacts. Who were you able? Where were you at, and who were you talking to?
Well, it was during the middle of the drive. I think I was in Kentucky, Tennessee, somewhere around there, and I was just talking to some people several hundred miles away. I don't really remember where they were right now, but just some local few hundred mile contacts.
So when you tell somebody that you're on CW, well, they know you're on CW, but they know you're running 1 watt mobile, what's their reaction usually?
Well, they can hardly believe it. You know, running 1 watt to a lot of them is pretty foreign to them, even from their home station with big antennas. But when they hear a QRP signal like that mobile, that gets them interested in doing it.
I was going to say, because, but you know, if you've got... Now, the antenna you were running, was this outside... Is it mounted, or were you using a little... You couldn't possibly be using a whip inside there.
Well, no, this was a one of our telescoping whips that, when it's fully extended, it's 8 feet, and there's a very high Q air-wound base loading coil. Q is about 300. That's pretty high Q. Now, the thing about this telescoping whip is that when I'm driving around town, it's too high, too tall for me to drive into my garage. So I can collapse it down where I can drive into the garage and operate around town. Now, around Starkville, I usually have a 10-meter, 10-watt radio, one of those that we make, 9410. And I can operate all over the U.S. and all over the northern hemisphere, into Europe, South America, just about any time when the bands are even just a little bit open. So, but, you know, if you're going somewhere where the antenna's not presentable, you just collapse it all the way down and nobody even notices it. Now, the loading course is, I don't know, maybe 8 inches tall, maybe an inch or two in diameter, but it has an alligator clip on it. So you can operate all bands from 40 meters through 2 meters with just one antenna.
Let me ask you this, for that particular antenna, dollars and cents-wise, what does it run ballpark-wise? Somebody wants to go HF in the car. You know, and I'm sure they're looking at a myriad of antennas. I know for HF, mm-hmm. I've looked at all kinds of stuff inside the car.
Okay. Well, the one that covers 40 meters through 2 meters, which includes the loading coil and the stainless steel telescope and whip, is retails for $89.95. Then there's a one that has a smaller loading coil that covers 20 through 2 meters at sales retail for $79.95. So all of those bands for that price is it's less expensive and much more compact and much more convenient than a whole trunk full of hamstick style antennas.
Now, let me ask you this question. How well do they do? Say, for example, how would you compare one of those on the 80-meter band to a hamstick?
Okay. Well, the whole key is the Q of that coil. You know, you can lose more than half of your power in a coil that's not very high Q. And this coil is designed to be very high Q. The 40-meter coil has a Q of around 300, which is far higher than any hamsticks. And you can get twice the amount of power or more compared to hamsticks.
I guess the thing of it is, there's two antennas on this planet that I never had much luck with. Now, I bet you fool with all kinds of things. I mean, somebody comes up with an antenna analyzer, I'm sure you've played more with antennas than anybody. But the two antennas I have never had any luck with at all to speak of has been the hamstick and the G5RV. I have never had any success with that thing, and I've never had any success with a hamstick. And outside of that arena, almost any antenna I've used has worked fairly well. I mean, you know, you also make another type of mobile antenna, and I can't remember what it's called, but it looks like a screwdriver, but the shaft has a screw at the bottom, and you can raise it and lower it to tune it.
What? Yeah, well, that's a manual screwdriver. I mean, it works exactly like a screwdriver, except you just go out there and move it by hand. Let me just mention something about hamsticks and G5RV. You know, the key to making both of those work is to be able to get power into the antenna, and that requires you to match it. Now, hamsticks, the Q is so low that the SWR is not terribly high when you resonate it, but you should put some kind of a matching network at the bottom. The simplest one to do would be something like a shunt coil. And if you put just a coil from the base of the antenna to ground and adjust it so you get the lowest SWR between 80 and 40 meters, it provides a pretty good match for all the other bands. But the same kind of thing is true for G5RB, and you really need to feed that mostly with a ladder line, something that pretty efficient. You don't lose a lot of power in the transmission line. But you have to use an antenna tuner so you can...
See, what I had seen on the G5RVs, and that is they would be balanced line would come down, and then it would join onto a piece of coax or a ballon or some sort of something.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would be 50 ohms on out. And then guys would take an antenna tuner and mess around with the antenna tuner going into the 50 ohm feed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, Todd. To me, that's like a disaster looking for a place to happen. Well, wouldn't you be better off with one of the MFJ tuners, open wire feed, straight up just to a dipole? Would that not be...
That's the best way. I mean, you shouldn't use much coax at all when you're using G5RV. That's just as a matter of convenience, or you can use some coax. But you're right. The absolute best way of doing it is to use some open wire feed.
Now, I'll tell you what I do have. I remember the times you and I have talked before, I forgot about this. I've got the differential T tuner.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a friend of mine's got the one that's got an extra knob on it, okay?
Uh-huh.
I'm one knob less than his, okay? Now, my question is, is he ahead of the game? Am I behind because I don't have the extra control, The differential T tuner, I don't know how much power that it takes. It's not some big, huge thing. I know you've done some bigger antenna tuners since I bought this one. But it seems like, to me, this thing is supposed to handle 1,500 watts PEP or something like that,
Mm-hmm.
Now, recently, my son David took it with him on a trip. And he said, man, Dad, he said, this thing will tune anything.
Yeah.
So... tell me a little about those okay. range of tuners, because
okay, well, the differential T, you're right, has two knobs for tuning it, and that's the biggest advantage of it, is that it's just so easy to tune, and there's only one position on each knob that gives you the lowest SWR, so it's a very sure way of tuning it. Now, when you use a normal T-network tuner, there's three knobs, and there are multiple places where it will tune up. What you have in the three-knob tuners is that you can control the cue of it, but it makes it much more difficult to tune. But the differential T can tune those same ranges of impedances. It may just be that you have a higher cue. You can't control the Q in a differential tuner, but that's not really much of a disadvantage. You can still tune everything.
The other thing I was going to ask, too, is what is the difference, and I've asked this before to other people, and of course you have a whole line of tuners, what is the difference between a tuner whose output is into a ballon or the link-coupled old-style tuners, like, for example, the old kilowatt matchbox? And do you make any link couple tuners? And if you don't make those, why have you decided not to? What's the advantage and disadvantage? I've had so many people ask me this, and I don't know anyone that can answer the question, but I bet you can answer that question.
Well, the more modern concept is the T-network tuner, and the reason that's so popular is because you can tune just about any range of impedances with component values that's in some normal range. Link couplers, they work good, except they are pretty limited in the range of impedances that it can tune. So you may have some antennas that it won't tune, and it takes a lot more playing around with it, because you may have to change the configuration physically. You may have to just make some different connections in order for that to tune. But the most versatile antenna tuner circuit is the T-network. It's not quite as efficient as an L-network, but you really can't tell any difference in the signal level between a T-network and an L-network. L-network is simpler in that it only takes two components instead of three components, but it's much harder to tune. If you can automate the antenna tuner, then it's easier to do an L network than a T network. So that's the reason that automatic tuners use L networks.
Is there much difference in the automatic antenna tuner arena? Like, for example, Alinco has their little EDX2. ICOM has theirs. I don't know what it's called. But you guys also put out automatic antenna tuners that are like they're built for mobile use. Others that are built for home or a base use, I guess I want to say. Mm-hmm. Of the mobile tuners, is there much difference in the way they're built and how they react and work? Are they any radical differences in them?
Well, they're basically all L network tuners, and the differences is in the components that's used. The capacitors, the quality of the capacitors, and the efficiency of the inductors, the Q of the inductors, and also in the relays that are used. In the tuners that we use 16-amp 1,000-volt relays, and which we just never have any problems. Some of the tuners use much smaller relays, and they have some problems in the relays burning up. But we have some in our tuners, some techniques that prevents any problems with the antenna tuners failing because of the voltage and the currents. And there's some software that we've developed that allows it to work with as much power over a very wide impedance range. The other thing that our line of IntelliTuners do is that it actually will measure the impedance of the antenna, and then it calculates the components that it needs to tune it, and then it just quickly snaps them all in. So the tuning of those is much faster.
The automatic antenna tuners are pretty quick as it is, though. I don't know. Now, we've lost our... Actually, Matt has one, and I have one of the Alinco DX70s. Mm-hmm. Small radios for the car. We've had those. And what's really interesting is that particular antenna tuner, we took a trip, and we just put some vertical poles in the back end of a pickup truck and ran a little wire loop back there and connected it up.
Yeah.
And I think that thing could tune in about maybe 15 seconds, maybe 20 seconds. And I was told it's one of the slower tuners.
Uh-huh.
So how fast can the things that you've got tune? I bet that's...
Well, you know, if it has to search through that entire combination of solutions, 256,000 combination, it could take much longer than 15, 20 seconds. But let me mention one of the other things that we do on the tuner is that the tuner actually learns when you're operating. Whenever you're operating on any given frequency, it will tune to that frequency and learn so that the next time you go back to that frequency, it will automatically pull the solution out of memory and you're instantly tuned up. So the more you operate, the more it learns and the more that it stores in memory, so it's almost totally instantaneously. And it'll get to the point where you don't even know the tuner is there. It's totally transparent. All you know is that you have a low SWR no matter where you operate.
So now if a person gets the high power version of the tuner, they get one of the antennas that obviously that you had to put in the car, and then they get one of the broadband amplifiers that you have, and one of the radios that does tuning automatically. That means that they can go from 160 to 10 and never touch a tuning knob, period.
That's right, yeah.
That's frightening.
Yeah.
That's really frightening, I think, you know. Tell me at this point a little bit what. You're holding up a flyer. Tell me about this. What is this?
Okay, I just wanted.
Well, you got an anniversary coming up for NFJ, and does that have to do with this? Or
yeah, that's what that is.
Aha! Well, let's talk about that. Let's hear about this.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to invite all of our ham friends to come and visit us on October the 5th and October the 6th of this year in Starkville, Mississippi. It's going to be our 40th year since we started MFJ back in 1972. We'll have all the factories. There are four buildings with all of them are factories there in Starkville that houses MFJ, Ameritron, Cushcraft, High Gain, Mirage, Vectronics, and there's also a metal shop where we build all the electronic cabinets, but all of them will be open. We'll have the employees there working, so you can see all the machines running and see how we build some of the products that you might have. Now, also, we'll have a free Mississippi fried chicken lunch with all the fixings for you. And so all that will be there. We will. You can have tailgating. You can bring all your stuff, and you can sell some of the stuff that you have. We'll have some VE test sessions where you can upgrade, and we're going to have door prizes from each one of the company. MFJ, Ameritron, you may win one of our high-power amplifiers, or maybe a big high gain of Cushcraft antennas and some products from Vectronics and Mirage. We're also going to have our MFJ club station on, K5 MFJ, and we'll be giving out certificates for working our special event station there. So I just wanted to welcome everybody and come and have some fun during October the 5th and October the 6th.
You know, what we need to do is we just mark this off on our calendar and come down and broadcast the thing. What do you think?
That would be absolutely wonderful. We would love for y'all to come down here.
Now,
just want to leave that with you.
Now, the question I have is, if we do that, will we be able to play with all the gadgets?
You can play with as many gadgets as you want to.
Well, we promise we won't break anything. We just want to know if we can play with all the gadgets.
Well, so. You may even want to interview some of the people who put these products together.
That would be a lot of fun. I'd really enjoy that. I just like I said, you know, I always tell the story of the MFJ CW filter, and I know that Martin probably sits down and cringes and says, "Oh God, he's going to tell that story again," you know. But it's very something very, very significant, because every time I just kept watching these products come out. It was just like after the CW filter, it was something else and something else and something else, and you know, the next thing you know, I mean, there's a catalog. And one thing that we're missing in ham radio today, well, there isn't much in the way of catalogs with gadgets. I mean, you know, I mean, and face it, what would ham radio be without gadgets today? We would be lost. I mean, so anyway, I really appreciate you coming by here. The other thing I was going to ask you about is, why don't you just briefly tell us a little bit about, I mean, because you're always coming up with new things. What are some of the new stuff that maybe that did not, you hadn't developed or didn't have out last year that you're doing this year?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. I brought this flyer with all of my new stuff in it. Well, we've got several things. One of them is an 8-band portable dipole that's made up of two 16-feet telescoping stainless steel whip antennas that can be mounted on a tripod with an adjustable loading coil that will cover all the bands from 80 meters up through 2 meters. It's a very highly efficient antenna, and you can adjust the frequency not only from the loading coil on the lower bands, but just by adjusting the length of the telescope and whip, you can have full quarter-wave dipole antennas. And we also have pretty much the same thing, except it's a vertical that will cover 40 through 2 meters, which consists of a 16-foot telescope and whip, a loading coil, and then you just throw a counterpoise wire on the ground and adjust it to the frequency that you want just by moving the alligator clip. We also have a trailer hitch where you can just slide it right into your trailer hitch and mount an HF antenna or VHF or UHF antenna. And those who have vertical antennas that like to work on them, we have a tilt mount base that you can mount the antenna and tilt it down really easily to do that. We've got a whole new line of QRP products, the little transceiver that covers 80, 40, 30, 20, 17, and 15 that uses those plug-in modules, and a series of QRP pocket products like a pocket antenna tuner, a pocket SWR meter, a pocket artificial ground, and a pocket watt meter that has a built-in dummy load and a pocket 4-to-1 ballon, and all those range from $19.95 to $49.95. Here's another interesting product. It's a it's a 10-meter vertical that you can mount on a small tripod, put it on your patio or on your balcony of your apartment, and be able to talk to all over the world on 10 meters, and this retails for $69.95. We've got some wideband 2-meter Yagis that we're bringing out, and a whole series of remote antenna tuners and a new digital controller. But anyway, there's just some of the products that's in that we brought here to Dayton. And let me give you this brand new 136-page catalog with some of the
products.
Yeah,
this is very, very cool. Let me ask this question though. While I've got you sitting here, because we got email just coming in from all over the place. The gentleman is asking. He said he likes to operate on the 80-meter band. Do you have anything in the way of an 80-meter low-profile antenna or something that can be mounted somewhere where it's relatively inconspicuous, where a person can get on 80 work, but then the emphasis was that he could be heard?
Okay.
Because I know low-profile antennas on 80 as a rule, they work, but they're not. So what have you discovered, or what do you have?
Well, at the high gain line, we have the 18 VS, which has got a very highly efficient loading coil, and it's pretty inexpensive too. You go out and you just adjust the tap on the loading coil for 80 meters, and that's probably as efficient as any of the low profile antennas that we have.
Now, what does that antenna look like? How much real estate does it take?
Okay, it's an antenna that's an aluminum pole. It's 22 feet tall, and it has a loading coil, air wound, high Q loading coil on the bottom. And just throw a few radios out, and you're able to operate anywhere you want to in the 80 meter band.
And I want to mention, too, folks, while you're listening, be sure and go up to our website, just qsoradioshow.com. You can email us. There's an email form there, and also just the email address by itself is just tedrandall@tedrandall.com, T-E-D-R-A-N-D-A-L-L at tedrandall.com. We're getting people writing from New Zealand and everywhere under the sun. The international shortwave station covers, a lot of area because it runs a lot of power. We got... let's see here. Be sure and put on your email, I want to win. We got KC1DH writing in. Richard, I don't know. There's just all kinds of... But the one fellow was wanting to know about the 80-meter antenna. And I thought, I would ask while you were here. So this is basically a vertical pole is what it amounts to.
Yeah.
How does that function as compared to an inverted V? A lot of guys on 80 run inverted Vs. Would it... Would it perform fairly well up against an inverted V?
Well, it really depends on if you want to work DX or you want to do some local communications. Something like an inverted V is probably more efficient, but the angle of radiation is fairly high, so it's much better for local communication, you know, talk within your state or within a couple of states. Now, verticals have a much lower angle radiation, and you have less absorption by the ground, so you can work DX much better. So vertical is good for DX, and inverted V and low dipoles are much better if you want to talk fairly locally.
Well, that makes sense. If you want to work DX, you get on the vertical, and if you're going to talk. You know. Well, I guess the inverted V is kind of like almost like a... what is it, an NVIS or antenna or cloud burner, you know, as they want to say it. Do you have anything in that order of...
Well, we have several antennas for the 80 and some dual band antennas for 80 and 40 meters. And all of them, if you mount them fairly low to ground, then they're all... will have high angle radiation. You're able to talk locally pretty good.
Well, that's very, very interesting. Now, of course, I'm a big fan of the Ameritron amplifiers, and you've got that company. Is there anything new coming out from Ameritron? Something different that maybe from last year, or is it basically the same line?
Well, we have some new amplifiers coming out. That high power ones, 12, 1300 watts and 600 watt ones that will cover, will include 6 meters at full power, and will be able to read the data from the radio and switch to bands. We also have some 6 meter and 2 meter high power amplifiers coming out also.
The amplifier that seems to me to be the ideal amplifier all the way around, especially for newcomers and just, you know, because of the ease and the ease of operation, the expense of replacing tubes, has got to be your 811 amplifier.
Well, you're right. That is by far the most popular amplifier, and there are more AL811s and AL811Hs than any other amplifier in the world. You know, for a long time, the Heathkit 220 was, there were more of those than any other amplifier in the world, but now the AL811 series has overtaken those. But you're right, that's a very popular amplifier.
Well, I was thinking the one that has just the three tubes in it.
Yeah.
It's got to be the most economical thing in the world to run. And how much difference is there? Let's say you go on the air with a three-tube 811 amplifier as opposed to the 3CX1500, you know, I mean, as far as in the field, how much difference is someone going to see?
Well, you know, one S unit is 5 or 6 dB, and if you double your power from 600 watts to 1200 watts, or if you use the 4-tube 811 amplifier, double that to 1500 watts, that's only a 3 dB increase, and you get maybe a half an S unit increase in signal. And with the really good AGC that we have in our radios now, you won't ever be able to hear the difference.
I was wondering about it, because I mean, to me it seems like you want to get over the noise. You know, you wanted to get over that noise level, and that's why I was saying that 811 amplifier is really the ideal situation. What's it cost to replace the tubes in that? Let's say the tubes go just dead. You know, you burn them up somehow or something. What's it cost to retube one of those things?
Well, you know, I don't remember what the cost of the tubes are. I mean, you know, that used to be pretty
high. I was asking a bit wild question. Well, let's put it this way. It's a lot more economical to retube one of those amplifiers than it is to retube, say, the AL1200 or whatever.
Oh, by far. Those tubes in the 1200 and the AL1500, those things are $900 to $1,500 now. And I think the 811 tees, I don't remember, but they're like $15, $20, $25 of each. So they're much, much cheaper. And they're very rugged tubes. And, I mean, they're just so much easier to use, an AL811. You know, you just plug it into a 110-volt outlet, and you're on the air.
There you go. Yeah, and I remember the 811s and the 572Bs and were a lot more inexpensive, and of course they were easy to get a hold of too. I remember back in a time when people were using the sweep tubes,
mm-hmm.
a television horizontal output sweep tubes, and those things were how can I say it? Inexpensive at the time, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden they got more expensive, and then they became extinct.
Yeah, you can't get those anymore. You
know, and there are a fair amount of those amps still running around, those sweep tubes. Now, someone says, I heard the other day, someone said, you can pull those sweep tubes out and put 811s in there. I'd never heard of that before. A fellow claims he's doing it on some of the older, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know how much.
Yeah. Well, maybe with some modifications. Yeah.
I don't know. I remember that we went through the whole thing on, especially I think it was on the Yaesu radios, where they were taking the sweep tubes out and retrofitting 6146s in them.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
Because you could get the 6146s. You know? Mm-hmm. But the 811A amplifier that this fellow here has at Ameritron. Is a workhorse. And it's a, you know, it's not so much power that you're gonna, you know, regret having the thing for whatever reason, mm-hmm. and then it's also inexpensive enough tube wise.
Yeah,
to be able to retube it. You know, is there anything else that you'd like to discuss or talk about? We'll be plugging this. Hopefully, we'll come down and broadcast. I'd love to have you back on the air.
Okay, you know? That would be absolutely wonderful if y'all could come down there and help us celebrate our 40th year. I know you've got tons of people here waiting in line to get on the air with you, and I need to run back to the booth. And
I would think you being gone from that booth would be something that, you know, do you actually, are you able to get out to the flea market much at all?
Well, I spent about an hour this morning in the flea market.
Oh, that doesn't even scratch the surface. Because I mean, all that does is make you mad because you got to leave.
You're right. Okay, well, thank you very much for
Martin, I thank you so much for coming by. I always enjoy talking to you.
Okay. Well, y'all have a good show now.
All right. Unfortunately, we're out of time here on this week's QSO. We want to invite you to go to our website, QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. Or become our friend on Facebook at QSO Radio Show and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. Once again, thank you very much for listening. We'll see you same time, same station next week.